always, we are wishing you the best. We love to hear from you. You can get in touch at naturalnurse.com or Facebook The Natural Nurse. We are actually flooded with requests to join in on our CE-certified classes. We have several going on this week and all the time, because we actually posted the classes on the CE Broker website. That's where people who need to get ongoing credits can visit to see what kind of classes they can take. And, of course, there are many in just conventional medicine, but we teach from a natural medicine perspective, and the courses are approved for CE credits for nurses and midwives, massage therapists, certified nutritionists, RDs, and many other professionals. So you can check that out at naturalnurse.com under calendar and see if you'd like to catch up on any of your credits by studying natural medicine. Also, you don't have to have a license. You can take the classes just for your own interest. And for that, we do give a certificate versus a credit. A credit would be for someone who needs it for their ongoing education. Today, we are so happy to have as our guest Dr. Corey Schuler. Corey Schuler is a thought leader, product innovator, and educator in integrative and functional medicine. He serves as the Director of Clinical Affairs for Integrative Therapeutics and is an assistant professor at the School of Health Sciences and Education at NYCC, that's New York Chiropractic College. He practices in Hudson, Wisconsin, as the owner of Metabolic Treatment Center. Corey is a registered nurse, licensed nutritionist, certified nutrition specialist, and also a chiropractor. Boy, you have you're an education junkie there, Corey. Ongoing list of certifications, right? It's not a bad thing, but it looks like you're never done learning.
No, never at all.
Yeah, so because that's really very interesting to be both an RN and a chiropractor. Which came first, going back in time?
The chiropractor did. I left my undergrad. My undergrad was in chemistry, and my intent was to be an industrial chemist. And then I was working at NASA Langley, actually, and we were working on components for satellites, like polymers and coatings. And I found myself really in that world of polymers and coatings and paints. And I just had sort of this epiphany that maybe there's more to what I can offer than that. And I had a little bit of an accident, actually. And so I ended up in natural medicine first. And so I got kind of flooded into the chiropractic practice and then continued to expand. Actually, the nursing degree is relatively new, and I'm furthering my education in nursing. I really should have started there because it fits my personality a lot, but hey, hindsight's 20/20.
This is true, but I'm very excited about that. So let me ask you this. Have you joined the American Holistic Nurses Association?
I just did, maybe a week or so ago.
Oh, excellent, because I'm very, very involved with that organization. And I lecture at their national conference all the time, and I think that you'll find that really fulfilling to be a part, because then it brings together nursing and healing.
Yeah, I actually met them at the American College of Nutrition, which I'm heavily involved in, and they were presenting there, and so I got to know them there. I started chatting with some of the leaders and thought, this is exactly what I've always wanted and done. I just haven't had the right credentials until now. So totally agree with that. And I can't wait to be at the next conference.
Yeah, I know you're going to love it. Boy, that is what an exciting path. All that education and that you're doing nursing later in life. It's not, and especially as a man, you know, we're very deficient of male nurses.
Yeah, I noticed and they always liked me in certain locations, and in other locations they didn't like me as much. So it really just depends. I mean, patients have preferences, and sometimes they wanted a man there, and sometimes not. And so I still sort of dealt with that. But yeah, it's interesting being a minority when I've never been a minority before.
People are looking at your picture. You're definitely not the picture of a minority. But then in community, you are. That's very interesting. We'll give you another whole, depth of understanding of life. It's very exciting. So you've done all these things. Now, on today's show, I know you have a myriad of topics you could talk about, but you chose to talk about the elemental diet for irritable bowel, inflammatory bowel, and small intestine bacterial overgrowth. I spelled it out because I know within the functional medicine community, everybody knows what these mean in terms of SIBO, but I would say in the mainstream community, they may not. So let's talk about why did you choose this as your topic for today?
Well, I love gut stuff, and when I talk to potential patients or patients even that have worked with me before, I say, you know what, if you have trouble with eating, like you're worried or uncomfortable when you're eating or you're having a bowel movement, that's when I want you to call me because that means that there's a problem with either things breaking down or things being excreted properly. And so I sort of fell in love with the gut. I fell in love with digestion, and I think that the functional medicine, integrative medicine world has always sort of been centered on gut function. But now I'm hearing more and more people talk about it in the language that I'm familiar with, as far as let's look at remote approaches, let's look at sort of these novel things. And so I'm really excited to be talking about irritable bowel, inflammatory bowel, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And all healthcare professionals, we shortcut everything, right? Everything's an acronym. So you hear about IBS and IBD and SIBO and CFO, which is a related thing, small intestinal fungal overgrowth. And it's all a bit of a related thing, but for the person that's out there listening, it's probably, if you have trouble eating or going to the bathroom, one of these things is probably in the mix.
Well, why would that be? I mean, because you're saying that these are actually disease states.
Well,
so are you saying
states,
everyone has some part of them?
Yeah, inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's, and ulcerative colitis are really the only disease states in there. Inflammatory or irritable bowel syndrome really is more of a condition or symptomatology or a constellation of symptoms that we're starting to develop better criteria about what it is and what it is not for kind of tracking purposes. But, you don't need a doctor to tell you you have irritable bowel syndrome when you have irritable bowels. Like, it's sort of a silly situation, right? You go to the doctor and say, my bowels are all irritable. What's the diagnosis? And the doctor says, irritable bowel. That's not really that helpful. That's just a description of that, of what's going on. And like I said, it has gotten some better definitions recently, but to extend that, SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, and CFO really aren't disease states. Like, they may be abnormal assessments, but I wouldn't consider them a disease state, because while they may have been going on for a while in some people, they are entirely reversible, and they're not necessarily an ICD-10 coded entity.
So you're saying that it's something that actually may be more prolific.
Yeah, and functional. You know, this is a functional diagnosis, functional gastroenterology. It's just about sort of dysfunction rather than disease.
So let's talk about SIBO, S-I-B-O, because that's probably the least recognized term.
Sure, yep, SIBO. Okay, so I'll step back and say irritable bowel syndrome is affecting probably 25 to 45 million people in the U.S. That's a bunch of people. That's a lot, right? Affecting a lot of people that are probably listening right now. But SIBO is thought to potentially affect 60% of those people, and some key opinion leaders may have even put that number a little bit higher, but there was a couple pieces of literature that really did a good job of trying to isolate, you know, groups of people that IBS, and they found that 60% was about average. And so that is the, that's what I was going to say. It's a functional diagnosis, and let me just describe it so people understand what it is. So small intestinal bacterial overgrowth by name sounds like an infection. It sounds like you have this bug inside of you and there's too much of it. And really, you know, that name is good for that. But what it is the good bacteria, the good microbes that are in your large intestine have migrated up towards your mouth and sort of settled in the small intestine. So it's not really that it's an overgrowth of the wrong ones. It's just the right guys in the wrong place. And so it's kind of like your friend who sits on your couch and they stay on your couch for a night, and that's okay. They can stay there for a night because they're your friend. But then they're there for a week, 2 weeks, a month, and they're still your friend, but you really want them to leave. And that's kind of the way I talk about SIBO, is that it's just the right things in the wrong place. And so now we think of this more as a GI motility disorder, whereas the gut's just not sweeping things in the right direction properly.
Right. So they're not maybe as disease-causing, but in this situation, they may lead to an imbalance.
Yeah, imbalance is probably the best term I could ever think of. When we eat, we stimulate motion from the mouth to the anus. And so you have that bolus of food, and it's designed to go through, you know, to go through from one end to the other. And then when you don't eat, there's this peristaltic wave. They call it the housekeeping wave. And that kind of goes through that same system and just keeps things moving in that general direction, like a good one-way street. But unfortunately, when that changes direction, becomes either a two-way street or a one-way street in the wrong way, that's when problems can occur. So that's how we think about this, is maybe this is caused by inflammation, maybe it's caused by some major neurological, not major neurological trauma, that's the wrong terminology, but a really significant event. The most common cause that we think of SIBO is going to be an acute gastroenteritis. So think of food poisoning or like the flu or something that made things go in the wrong direction, and that caused the immune system to get excited and maybe even cause autoimmunity to part of that motility system. So I know that's sort of complicated, but essentially it just means that an event happened and now things don't work the way they're supposed to.
Well, what are some of the symptoms that someone listening today might be experiencing that might give them a heads up that they should maybe be looking into these issues?
Yeah, so the most common, you know, SIBO symptoms are things like gas and bloating, and I separate those two. Some people kind of say it together, gas and bloating are the same thing, but I really think of it as gas is more like the flatulence, and bloating is looking like there's something growing inside your stomach. I've had patients, slender patients, 100-pound patients who will eat a regular meal, what somebody would call a regular meal, and look like they're 6 months, 7 months pregnant. Like it just balloons up, and it's very uncomfortable. And that's sort of the hallmark of small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, because the bacteria that are in there in the wrong place, they ferment. They eat your food, and they cause gas. So they cause either hydrogen or methane, or in some cases, hydrogen sulfide, like that egg smell. And that gas doesn't have anywhere to go. So it can go outward with flatulence. That's sort of a natural way to get rid of it. But if it doesn't get rid of it, and it doesn't have anywhere to go, it just expands out. And so the bloating can cause that cramping. Obviously, it's taking up a ton of space, so it's very painful in the abdomen. It can also push upward towards the stomach and cause things like GERD or gastroesophageal reflux disorder, heartburn, those sorts of symptoms like that. And then those are the local symptoms of SIBO. But very interestingly, we get further out, you know, we start looking around the body, and we find that some people with SIBO are diarrhea dominant, and they have diarrhea often, and some people are constipation dominant, and they rarely have a bowel movement, or if so, they need aids to do so. And then there's other things like brain fog tends to happen. Sometimes it's like more like joint pain can happen, and we start seeing all of these different changes related to SIBO, but those are the big ones.
Right. So if people are having those kinds of symptoms and issues, and they're going to their regular doctor or their regular gastroenterologist even, very often this is not going to be addressed.
Yeah, it usually isn't. Now, it's getting addressed more and more often, but if you have gas and bloating and quite oftentimes, it's sort of just seen as a annoying symptom. Now, if you're like that patient I just described that looks like they're, you know, 6 months pregnant and they can't wear their pants and they, you know, can't go out in public and they have to spot their next bathroom for in case of diarrhea, that's a hard way to live. So what a gastroenterologist will typically do is they'll do a scope and see if it's inflammatory bowel. And if it's not Crohn's or ulcerative colitis or microscopic colitis, they will likely give you something like a proton pump inhibitor or a histamine blocker, so things like Zantac or ranitidine, Prilosec is a proton pump inhibitor that's common because you're having like GERD, you're having excess gas. So that is some things that are usually given, but usually not more than that. They don't spend a lot of time trying to figure out what's causing it, and they're not doing breath tests and those other assessments which we might see in integrative medicine.
Oh, well, that's a very interesting topic to go in. So you're saying there are other tests that you might do which would not be done in most cases by a mainstream gastroenterologist.
Yeah, and these tests are actually fairly common in integrative medicine, and they're becoming more common even in all kinds of places. In fact, I've had people from major hospitals and major university-type settings have these tests done, so I know that people are doing them, and sometimes they have the in-house lab. So the tests are called the hydrogen breath tests, or HBT, and actually a lot of gastroenterologists have gotten together and have a North American consensus on the use, the preparation, et cetera, of this. So it really is becoming a bit more mainstream, but it certainly hasn't caught on. Now, I'll describe the test because I think it's important for people to know there's a couple different kinds. One is that you have a preparation, and usually the preparation is very strict diet as far as like thing, if you tolerate it, white rice, chicken, broth, pretty bland foods, and then you do a 12-hour fast, and then you mix up this solution of sugar. And the sugar is one of two things. It's either lactulose, which is a big sugar that's usually not broken down by the body, or glucose, which is usually proximally absorbed by the body. So glucose or lactulose. And those, you get to pick one, right? And you consume this solution. You do it by weight. So there's instructions on how to do that. And then over the period of about 3 hours, some tests are 2 hours, but most are 3 hours, you do breath tests into this breath collection system. Like it's a big bag. You blow into the bag, and then you take the like the sample collection, and you gather the gases. And so the result is you get a graph and a table showing how much parts per million, so how much gas you blew out during the 2 to 3 hours. And what that tells you, see, humans don't make hydrogen and humans don't make methane. And so if we're taking in that sugar and then we're blowing out either hydrogen or methane, that's an abnormal state. And that's what we're looking for on that test.
Oh, so that's really interesting because that's something that would identify that there is a microorganism creating those gases, which a normal gastrointestinal tract would not do.
Correct.
Okay, well, that makes sense. So where can people get that kind of test?
So those are always, they're always practitioner-ordered tests. So if you have a naturopathic doctor or a chiropractic doctor or integrative medical doctor who's a nurse practitioner, PA, they have to have an ability to order. But there's a variety of labs now that do that kind of test. The one that I like is out of Lexington, Mass., and they're a great lab, and they really are helpful for both the practitioner and the customer, and so I like to send my samples there.
Because you find that they're reliable.
They're reliable tests and useful customer service. And there's the collection company is actually out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which is just on the other side of my state. And if the lab is using, and that lab name is Quintron, if they're using the Quintron collection system, then you know that we're at least doing it the right way, because that can distinguish between alveolar, or your lung air, versus air that's just ambient in the environment. And so I like the Quintron system, and a couple different labs are using that system.
Oh, that's interesting. I haven't heard of that. So it would be a different way of measuring it, and you feel that one is the best.
Yes. Yep.
Well, that's something people can ask their functional practitioner to see if they have that available. I find, as being someone who I live in Florida and in New York, that in New York is a lot of limitations in terms of lab testing. For instance, we cannot do hair analysis. We cannot do IgG food allergy analysis. So I'm just wondering if this test is available in New York.
You know, that's a great question, and that's one that I haven't looked at. And interestingly enough, you know, and it used to be there too, but I would teach at New York Chiropractic College, but I teach online. And so many of my students who are taking my lab course, they're not even in New York. They're in other places. And so that kind of question doesn't come up as often as it used to, but we used to be very particular about that. New York, New Jersey, Rhode Island, and I think there's a couple of other states that are real finicky about which tests you can and can't order, and it doesn't make a ton of sense to me why that is. But
I never figured it out. But nonetheless, you know, that's the problem. You don't want a doctor ordering it and then having all kinds of, PayPals and having sort of a conversation with the powers that be, which could be very annoying and can cost money. You can be fined, that kind of thing. So anyway, we do need to take a slight break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We are talking today with Corey Schuler, and you can find out more at his website, metabolictreatmentcenter.com. That's a good place to look for him. Would you say that's a good website, or do you have another one you'd like to give out?
That's the best place to find me.
Excellent. So that's Metabolic Treatment Center. Easy to remember. We're going to go on a little break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And when we come back, we're going to head into the elemental diet, which supports these problematic situations and can really make a difference in your life. So we'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll take a look at the soybean, its phytochemistry, and its role as a food and medicine.
It is exciting to see a resurgence in research by universities and food scientists on the role that foods play in disease prevention. Many of these institutions, such as the United Soybean Board, the American Soybean Farmers Association, and the National Cancer Institute, are busy developing designer foods, or superfoods, concentrating the essential nutrients and phytochemicals in soybeans and other foods that have potent medicinal effects. Commonly known foods which have soy in them include soy milk, a cheese-like substance called tofu, tempeh, a fermented soy protein, and tamari, a fermented soy sauce. The soybean is a rich source of many nutrients, including selenium, zinc, beta-carotene, vitamins A, C, and E, and 20 of the 22 amino acids. Soy also contains essential fatty acids.
Research on soy foods is vast and well known to health enthusiasts, although the general public and physicians in the United States may not be aware of this plethora of research. In Japan and China, however, this is not the case, as a voluminous number of scientific studies have been carried out in animals and humans. Chinese studies reveal that soy products can increase the ability, rate of activity, and number of white blood cells. Patients receiving chemotherapy and radiation can benefit from drinking soy milk, which in several studies demonstrated a protective effect on the liver and gastrointestinal system.
It is interesting to note that the British journal Lancet revealed that vegetarians and Asians who ingest high amounts of soy have the lowest rates of cancer. This is due to one of soy's constituents called genistein. This chemical is a phytoestrogen or plant estrogen, which can decrease and block the uptake of human estrogen and testosterone, as well as enhance its excretion. Like the drug tamoxifen, it competes with estrogen for uptake in the reproductive tissues. By doing so, hormone-dependent cancers like ovarian, breast, and prostate cancers may be prevented.
In conditions where there is a deficiency of hormones, such as osteoporosis and menopause, soy isoflavones, such as genistein, can weakly mimic estrogen and reduce the severity of these problems.
So, listeners, don't count out the versatile soybean. Make it a delicious and nutritious part of your natural medicine chest.
More right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, and we're so happy that you're joining us today. We love to hear from you. You can email us by visiting naturalnurse.com or Facebook The Natural Nurse and send a message. And we love to join you in person. We have lots of field classes where we go outside, gather wild, edible, medicinal plants, and actually make them into medicine. And you take home your own tinctures, salves, and smudge sticks, and other herbal fun shop kinds of things. So you can join us there. You can join us in the island of Jamaica to live with shamanic healers for a week. We have that class once a year, every March, and that actually does have college credits. And you can join us also for our CE broker courses. If you have any kind of license that you'd like to keep intact, we have a class coming up, I think that's tomorrow night, on thyroid and adrenal, and we have one on leaky gut syndrome, very similar to our conversation today, and that's next week. So all of those grant CE broker credits for those people who need them for their ongoing education, and they're also open to the general public, so anyone can take them. You can go to naturalnurse.com under calendar to find out more. And today we're so happy to have as our guest Corey Schuler, who is a nurse as well as a chiropractor and a certified nutritionist and also has a master's, I imagine, of master's in nutrition perhaps, Corey, and a long list of letters after his name. He has been studying all of these things for a very, very long time, and he's sharing with us today about things that influence the gut, such as IBS, IBD, and SIBO. He is also a professor in the School of Health Sciences and Education at NYCC, and that course is accessible online, which is excellent for any of you who want to get a master's in clinical nutrition. And so thank you so much for being our guest today, Corey.
Oh, it's been fun, Ellen. This is great. I love talking about this. This is probably one of my favorite topics.
Well, that's where we're going there. And let's move forward. We talked about the problems that people might be experiencing with bloating and, I guess, you know, all kinds of nausea and discomfort, particularly after eating. And unfortunately, an awful lot of people do complain of these things. You know, it shouldn't really be the norm.
No, it shouldn't at all. And people have gone through the proverbial ringer as trying to figure it out oftentimes just because they probably haven't gotten the help they need. And so they've looked to themselves, but they've looked to friends and family and support groups to figure out what to do. And so a lot of times people with those issues, they know that the problem's associated with eating. They might have, you know, diarrhea or constipation. So then they look down the barrel of, well, it must be the food I'm eating. And they're not necessarily wrong, but there's a lot of ideas on what kind of diets are helpful for it. And so we've rounded in on a few primary diets, things like a low FODMAP diet is one of them. That's the low fermentation potential diet. There's something called the specific carbohydrate diet. Some people will use a ketogenic diet for working with their own SIBO or GI issues, and the list kind of goes on, and the list gets really long, unfortunately.
Okay, so I see that you're mentioning something called the elemental diet.
Yeah, the elemental diet, I mean, sort of is a misnomer because it really isn't. I think of diet as like a lifestyle, like a way of eating, and elemental diet really isn't that way at all. The elemental diet is essentially, it's free-form amino acids, it's easily available or absorbable fats like medium-chain triglycerides, and then balanced micronutrients. And so it's always found as a powder or a ready-to-drink type of meal replacement, essentially. And it's been used as sole nutrition in certain patient populations now since really not as much, but it started in the 1940s. And so this isn't a lifestyle at all. It's more of a procedure. I would think of it like for anywhere between 3 days and I guess as far as long as 3 months. But most of the literature that's been published on the elemental diet is in the range of 2 to 4 weeks. So 2 to 4 weeks of this procedure in order to eradicate or reduce colony counts of SIBO, to heal things like Crohn's or ulcerative colitis. Is sort of the approach. Now, the reason that it works, and there's a lot of reasons, but I'll name the few, is a lot of times the people that are suffering with these conditions don't absorb nutrients very well, and so these are easily absorbed nutrients, so we can raise nutritional status of the individuals. The other thing is that it doesn't require a lot of breakdown. So proteins, if we kind of go way back to normal biochemistry, are very complex. There's a quaternary structure of a protein. You have to break that down to a tertiary structure and a secondary structure all the way down to their primary structure. So think of like a protein as like a whole garage for your car, and an amino acid is more like, I don't know, like the hammer that you find in the garage. Like it's just it's so different, and it's much more easily absorbed as amino acids. And so there's that, the stress of major digestion that occurs with the elemental diet, and that's probably the biggest difference between that and maybe other protein products or protein powders, etc. And then the last thing is that it's a low antigen load, so it doesn't cause inflammation that could be occurring. So a lot of times people do food elimination diets and those sorts of things, and this is free. An elemental diet is supposed to be free of a lot of those major allergens. And so in those sort of three ways, that makes up the elemental diet. And I can talk about that a little bit. And what I want to talk about actually is kind of where it started, because it's a little bit of a funny story. There was a biochemistry professor named Rose, W.C. Rose, in the 1940s. And he did what some professors still do to their graduate students today, and that's torture them a bit. He felt this idea of an elemental diet was a good idea, and so he mixed up this really disgusting mixture of elemental-type things in their most easily absorbable form. So things like, I think he had butterfat, cornstarch, sucrose, some inorganic salt, and then because he didn't know what vitamins were needed, he actually took liver extract and supplied the vitamins that weren't maybe known or well known and just mixed that. And so you can imagine the taste of that was pretty bad.
Yes.
So this happened in the University of Illinois. And so think about a bunch of farm kids going to graduate school, trying to get their PhD, and their professors giving them this stuff. And He did do one little thing that was nice, though. He gave him peppermint oil for flavor because it was just nearly intolerable. And the one thing that he found when he gave it to his grad students is, and these are just volunteers, they're not people with IBS, IBD, blah, 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 that they improved their nitrogen balance. And that was for weeks without any complications, and they weren't eating other food, which a nitrogen balance, just for people listening, is sort of your a good measure of if you're wasting away or if you're doing okay, and you're being able to use the proteins that you're ingesting. So that was the first good news of the elemental diet back in the 1940s.
Oh, so it's that old. This is not a new jump on the bandwagon discussion.
No, this isn't something that I'm writing a book about either and want to promote, which is fine to do. But no, this is something that has been around for a while, but it's been used in hospital type of situations. We talk about enteral formulas, whereas you use like a nasogastric tube or a nasojejunal tube, and you might use like a PEG tube. So all these are all hospital procedures, right? So they're putting food directly into the gastrointestinal system and usually bypassing the mouth. And so even if they taste horrible, for most patients in the hospital, it didn't matter because they weren't ever tasting it. It was just going in and it was just like rough nutrition so that they could live. But we saw progress in the late 70s, 80s, where people started saying, well, if we can use an elemental diet to keep people out of big, big trouble when they have Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, what about when those people go home? Would there be any benefit to giving it to those people so they don't have to come back to the hospital as often? Or, let's take it a step further, what if they could take this stuff home and use it on a periodic basis so that they never had to come to the hospital and actually prevent some of these issues? What if we could do that? And so thoughts started going, and it started to be used in more clinical research settings to answer some of those questions, and the results were very positive, actually.
Well, so this is a product that someone can get a hold of, or they have to get it from a hospital setting?
So this is elemental diets, and there's a variety of elemental diets on the market. There's not just one. Elemental diets are available typically by either prescription. They sort of fall in this weird category of medical food, so they're not available in the open market. They're designed to be used under medical supervision, and there's good reason for that. If you're only drinking some product and you're not actually consuming other foods, then your nutrition status is based entirely on what the formulators of that product did right. And that formulator of that product, while they may be brilliant, they don't know you and your biochemical individual needs. However, if you're using a product like that and working with an integrative practitioner or a conventional practitioner who does know you and can pay attention to your symptoms and how you're doing with it, then you can sort of marry those things together and see if you're doing it the right way, the wrong way, if you need more, if you need less, if you should keep going or not go further, et cetera. So that's kind of where it all plays out.
Well, are there any specific foods that might help, you know, either discouraging their use or encouraging their use?
For small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, most people are recommending that we steer away from easily fermentable carbohydrates.
And so what would that be?
It ends up being the foods that we thought were really good for us, things like brown rice, which has high fiber content, generally fibrous foods because it's not digestible. It's just broken down by the microbes and not by us very well. So it's usually low glycemic, high fiber type of starches that tend to be the things to be avoided. For IBS and IBD, that starts to fall away a little bit because we've seen vegetarian diets work really well in certain cases of that, et cetera. So it gets a little bit more specific with small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, but not the others.
So that's interesting. Brown rice, that's something that's often discussed as being actually very healing and sort of anti-inflammatory.
It does. It has lots of anti-inflammatory properties. Generally, fiber is really good for bowel movements. It keeps the diarrhea away and keeps the constipation away generally. But if you've had sort of that bad motility problem and the right microbes are in the wrong place, it may not be good for you. So actually, that's a good thing to mention, is that if you're eating a healthy diet and you have good fiber and you're doing really well with that based on recommendations that have been given in other places, but every time you do, you feel like garbage, that might be a sign that says, hey, maybe I should pay attention to why that is. That would be somebody that I would want to test for SIBO. Another one would be another healthy, healing product or thing is fermented foods. Fermented foods and probiotics, oftentimes when those help the same kind of deal. But if those don't go well for you, sometimes it's the prebiotic, the fiber that's in the probiotic, that makes things worse, and sometimes it's the probiotic itself. If you've done all these good things for yourself and you're feeling worse because of it, that could be another sign that maybe this is what you're suffering from. So those are just some pointers that I would recommend to everybody.
Okay. Now, what about the often maligned wheat, which we hear so much about?
Yeah, so generally, I'll share my experiences with that. I recommend that people avoid, they either get tested, not just for celiac disease, but we try to do more advanced testing to see if there's non-celiac gluten intolerance, which I'm sure people are now getting familiar with, that you don't have to have celiac to avoid wheat. Until we figure it out for you, for the person sitting in front of me, I'm recommending no wheat, no dairy, limited or no corn, limited eggs. There's a few of those major intolerances that don't do very well for people. And then usually I have to remove the disaccharides and sugar alcohol. So things like chewing gum are often things that get thrown out. I'm a little bit careful, and I'm maybe not as, how do I say, there's people that are stronger against wheat and gluten than I am, but in this case, I just have to control for variables, and I have to know, are we dealing with celiac disease? Are we dealing with non-celiac gluten intolerance, or are we dealing with small intestinal bacterial overgrowth? And the reason that I have to minimize how many variables are involved in that is because the symptoms are often identical. You can have the exact same symptoms, but a completely different diagnosis. So we have to just sort it out, and once we sort it out, then we can identify if you can incorporate that back into your diet or not.
Well, that's certainly a good step-by-step approach. We're going to take another break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, because you're listening to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z right here on Progressive Radio Network. Our guest today is Corey Schuler. Dr. Schuler has a long list of degrees, as well as being a nurse and a chiropractor. And he is discussing with us today some of the latest research about the elemental diet and various kinds of digestive difficulties. And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion. And now we're going to go to PRN, Progressive Radio Network, because there's so many great shows that you can hear on this station. We'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
You're tuned to PRN. We'll keep bringing you the best in alternative voices for social and political news, the environment, health, the economy, and a whole lot more. All you have to do is keep listening. PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Love, lust, and laughter. Tuesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm your host, Dr. Diana Wiley, a board-certified sex therapist and a marriage and family therapist. Guests, colleagues, authors are interviewed, and we sometimes dispense advice to create a format that is both informative and entertaining. If you can't listen live, go to the archives and even rate the show on iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope that you are coming with us.
Next time on Peace Talks Radio, forgiveness on a grand scale, as the family of American anti-apartheid activist Amy Beale worked together with two men who were involved in her 1993 murder in South Africa, working to improve conditions for South African youth and improve race relations there.
And then they started calling me Makulu. Oh, what's that? Grandmother. And my husband, Dom Kulu. It's like, what is this? I think they adopted us.
That's next time on Peace Talks Radio.
Progressive Radio Network, the number one network for those who care about the truth.
And welcome back to more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, and we're here today with our guest, Dr. Corey Schuler, registered nurse, licensed nutritionist, certified nutrition specialist, and doctor of chiropractic, et cetera. Very, very educated, as Corey says on his website. You know, we all have our little addictions, and his is to education, which really there could be worse things to be addicted to, that's for sure. Now, if people visit your website, Dr. Corey, metabolictreatmentcenter.com, is there something that could be accessed remotely, like if someone doesn't live in your area but wanted to consult with you about what might be best for them?
Yeah, we routinely talk to people from all over the country just to get them on the right path. And so, yeah, we do virtual consultations with people suffering from a variety of things, but we do mainly look at things like GI health. And so some people have lots of records and all that kind of thing, which we love to see and pay attention to. But to answer your question, yes, we can work with people from just about anywhere.
That's excellent, because you have a higher knowledge about a lot of these testing modalities, especially if someone doesn't, you know, very often people are just uncomfortable all the time in terms of their digestive health. But if they go to a GI specialist, they're told, well, there's really nothing wrong with you, because it's nothing that requires surgery, let's say. And they'll usually just give them a proton pump inhibitor, which might alleviate the symptoms, but what does that not do?
It doesn't address the cause, and that would be probably the biggest kind of insult to the patient, as far as, because you think you got it worked out, right? I went to the doctor assessed me, the doctor gave me something, and it feels a little bit better, but now whatever was going on is still brewing. So proton pump inhibitors don't really do much for gut motility. They don't knock down bacterial overgrowth or fungal overgrowth. There's a lot of things that they don't do, and so you miss the cause.
So what would you do if a patient calls you up and then they can fax you or email you, let's say, whatever blood work they already had done, and then what would you do?
We would do the old sleuthing method of figuring out what are the contributors that, you know, started their problem. Are those modifiable? Sometimes, you know, we can't go back in time and change the fact that they had acute gastroenteritis or food poisoning. So, okay, can't change that. And we just go back as far as we can to the modifiable factors. And it comes down to really natural, healthy living most of the time. How stressed are you? Are you managing that stress? Are you eating foods that are good for your constitution or not? And have we determined what those foods are? Those are usually good actionable items. Are you sleeping well? Because if you don't sleep, you don't recover. And so it gets down into really basic stuff, which doesn't seem very basic sometimes, because we get it complicated and we make sure that we have to, you know, code it right. And there's a specialist for that. So, it's fundamental type of work, but it comes down to a good old-fashioned history and me putting that fat between my ears to the clues and the problems that are going on.
Now, can you order some of these digestive analysis as you discussed?
Yeah, they're actually home testing kits. So I mentioned
Excellent.
The glucose breath test, the lactulose breath test. The kit is actually shipped directly to patients, and then they're instructed on how to prep for it, how to do the test, and then they ship it off in a nice clean box, and then the results are provided to their practitioner.
Which would be you if you were ordering it.
Yes.
Right. So that's really good. So you can discuss with somebody, let's say, I don't know, do they send you a diet diary perhaps so you can evaluate what they're eating?
Yep, I ask everybody for at least a 3-day food diary. Some people are more diligent and they send me way more. And if they don't and they're not very good about keeping track, then I'll do like a 24-hour recall just to get an idea of what they're eating. Generally, that's enough for me to move things forward. But yeah, I always like to monitor things. I also like to monitor things like sleep, energy, pain, and mood. And you might be thinking, Corey, that has nothing to do with your GI. And I say, you know, it has everything to do with your GI. So I always ask people to monitor those things over a period of time, actually the whole time we're working together, so that I can identify what's making progress and what's not. Because sleep, energy, mood, and pain actually change faster than some of these more chronic GI conditions. So I can see that we're making some progress as from the constitutional health basis, and then I know that we're on the right path.
So that's good. So you actually can work with a patient, even long distance, send them some test kits to see if you can really dig down into whatever the root cause, and from there make dietary recommendations. Now, the elemental diet, is that something that you might consider as a treatment, or is that only with certain people?
It's generally one of my go-to uses for things like Crohn's disease and small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, or people that just need gut rest. You know, as we talk about, we should go to Tahiti or go to Fiji and rest for a while, our whole bodies, right? Take a vacation. Well, your gut works
a
lot.
That'll fix anything, right?
works all the time. We're eating however many times a day, and every time we do that, our gut is working. So I'm thinking, you know what, maybe we need just a gut vacation. And so sometimes an elemental diet, because everything's so easily absorbed, that's sort of a good approach for that. The other treatments for it are usually antibiotic treatments. Remember how I said at the beginning small intestinal bacterial overgrowth is thought of just by name as like an infection, an overgrowth. And so one of the ways to reduce that load is antibiotics. Now, there's the older antibiotics, which are, you know, have systemic effects and maybe not as good, but the newer antibiotics that we're using now are more luminal agents. They stay in the lumen of the gastrointestinal tract. And I usually see people after they've done a round or two of those luminal agent antibiotics. And so it's silly to go down that path again. So instead, we go down the path of elemental diets or maybe herbal antimicrobials. And then definitely changing food and lifestyle so that we can have a plan moving forward, because that's what I think is the best as far as like having hope and security, is that I know that I have a plan. And even if I have a bad day or a bad week or things are starting to get out of control, I can get control because I have a plan on what to do when things aren't going well. And so that's really what I like to offer people.
Well, actually, looking at herbals can be really helpful because so many herbals are broad-spectrum antimicrobials, but they do not create resistant strains.
Right, yeah. So I have some favorites to that, and we probably each have our own list of a long list of favorites, actually. I like berberine for that. I like neem. Oil of oregano is good, but I also like things like paw d'arco, and caprylic acid, not really an herb, but definitely a natural product. There's a whole bunch of things that I really, really like that can be useful for that. There actually has been some thought process that oil of oregano may cause some resistance, but that's not really, we don't know that for sure yet. That's just
That's the first I ever heard of it. So if you get more information about that, please send it my way.
Yeah, absolutely.
I never heard of that. I've been studying, actually, the mechanism of berberine and the fact that it actually increases the efflux pump and it dampens the efflux pump so that it doesn't pump out the antibiotics from the cell, which is very unique to berberine. That's interesting. But I didn't hear that about oil of oregano. So, yeah, definitely let me know. Well, believe it or not, we've come to the end of our time together. I want to thank you so much for being our guest. Really, really interesting, cutting edge. It's just amazing. This should be something that I think every gastroenterologist should use as the preferred system of treating these kinds of problems, rather than just, like you said, going with antibiotics and, moving rather quickly towards resection or whatever, you know, that's just not really going to fix the problem. So I think it's excellent for everyone. And everything you do, I mean, look at your education. It's really science-based. And there's so many studies in the literature really supporting the kind of treatment that you're doing. And it should be standard of practice in conventional medicine.
I agree wholeheartedly with the fact that this should be more incorporated into the standard of care and more conventional doctors looking at it. I really appreciate you saying that.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest today, Corey Schuler. And until next time, I will say goodbye to our listeners. By the way, this show will be archived. Corey, I will send you a link so you can post it anywhere you like as well. And if you heard something today that you think someone else should hear, the show will be archived here on Progressive Radio Network and is widely available into the foreseeable future. So until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, and hoping that you stay healthy.